Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. It's Potpourri number 5 today, featuring a press review, Noam Chomsky, Ralph Nader, and some music. As they say on Debbie Does Dallas, we have something for everyone, and everybody likes something. I hope you'll stay tuned. This is Potpourri number 5. Potpourri is a lovely, fragrant term, which means a bit of this and a bit of that. Potpourri sounds a little nicer than hodgepodge, and sounds less ethnic than smorgasbord. Remember the term smorgasbord? Today we call it a buffet, which is easier to spell and pronounce, though still a foreign word. I've started a movement to bring back the good old Middle English word hodgepodge. To further this important work, send your generous financial contribution to my offshore tax haven, New World Notes, care of Second National Bank of Trinidad and Tobago, Pembroke, Tobago. And great will be your reward in West Virginia, which is almost heaven, if you can believe their license plates. But for the moment, potpourri it is. We'll have our offbeat press review, music by David Rovix, and part of a nice interview of Noam Chomsky by Ralph Nader, two of my personal heroes. Let's start off with a press review. Fanfare, please. New World Notes' press review presents a hodgepodge of stories you might have missed. Nuggets of gold gleaned from the sewers of the corporate-controlled press. First off, I hope you celebrated National Lobster Day appropriately. Yes, if this week's Stop and Shop supermarket circular is to be believed, Monday, September 25 was National Lobster Day. I celebrated by visiting the lobster shelter at my local supermarket and adopting one. I took it for a walk, then took it to lunch at Popeye's. According to reports, the early 19th century French poet Gérard de Nerval had a pet lobster. He would walk the lobster on a leash on the grounds of the Palais Royal in Paris. Nerval once explained, quote, "Why should a lobster be any more ridiculous than a dog? I have a liking for lobsters. They are peaceful, serious creatures. They know the secrets of the sea. They don't bark, and they don't gobble up your privacy the way dogs do. Goethe hated dogs, and he wasn't crazy." Unquote. Nerval forgot to mention another benefit of adopting a lobster. When you get bored with your pet, you can kill him, cook him, and eat him. Sure, you can do that with your dog or horse, too, but then the SPCA and PETA and all the other bleeding-heart liberals will get on your case and make life hell for you for several months. And the county will take your children and put them in foster homes. Kill and eat a lobster? At worst, PETA will give you a dirty look. The SPCA and child welfare won't bat an eyelash. So, a toast to our crustacean friends on National Lobster Day, September 25. Not all of the items in our press review are as up-to-date as the last one. This clipping has been hanging around for over a year. Big headline in my local daily paper, the Journal Inquirer of No Fixed Address. This story wins the Hubris Award, hands down. The headline is a quotation, in quotation marks. Quote, "We conquered Jupiter," unquote. Yes, a NASA Juno spacecraft did not explode on the launch pad and managed, after 5 years, to make it to the planet Jupiter. And it began orbiting the planet. Juno's chief scientist, Scott Bolton, announced, quote, "We're there. We're in orbit. We conquered Jupiter," unquote. Maybe you can think of a better example of hubris. I can't. You send a rocket into orbit, and then you announce that you have conquered the largest planet in the solar system? This from a country that was unable to conquer North Vietnam after 20 years of trying, and 10 years of seriously trying. This from a country that has been unable to conquer Afghanistan after 16 years of trying. Some mighty conqueror. Now we're claiming to have conquered a planet roughly 23 gazillion times the size of Afghanistan. A planet on which we've never set foot and shall not set foot in the foreseeable future, if ever. That's how we should have conquered Afghanistan. Fly a plane around it, never set foot in it, declare victory, go home and celebrate. Works for me. And it would have worked in Vietnam, too. But to compare great things with small, my local paper, the Journal Enquirer, is always publishing announcements like this one. This is a news story. And I quote, "Manchester will hold DUI checkpoint on Main Street." Manchester, the police department will be conducting a sobriety checkpoint on Main Street between Park and Oak Streets from 8 p.m. Friday until 2 a.m. Saturday. Officers will be looking for drivers who are impaired and unsafe to drive. Additionally, officers will be targeting dangerous driving behaviors, such as failing to wear seatbelts and using electronic devices while driving. Okay, that's the end of that article. Well, on behalf of drunks on wheels everywhere, thank you for the warning, officers. So if, like me, you plan to drive drunk through downtown Manchester this Friday night, perhaps texting as you weave back and forth, don't drive on that block of Main Street in front of St. James Church. Got it? Beware of the big white church on the left as you're weaving back and forth more or less northwards. That's where the checkpoint will be, according to the announcement. Intoxicated drivers, cell phone addicts, and people in stolen cars, remember to avoid Manchester's Main Street this Friday night only. Take Spruce Street instead. That's just one block to the east, parallel to Main, and that'll get you to the next tavern on your list in very little extra time. Thank you, Manchester Police Department, for helping to get drunk and distracted drivers off Main Street and onto Spruce Street, where the rents are lower. Your tax dollars at work. And drinkers, keep reading the Journal Enquirer for more advance warnings of when and where the cops will be stopping drunks like you next time. Seriously, dear listener, maybe you can figure out why the police give advance notice of when and where their drunk driving checkpoints will be. I give up. Okay, our press review has time for one more item. Let's see. Fire at Massachusetts Fire Station? Save that one for next time. Here's a crime report. The crime isn't a huge one, but I think the story reveals some important truths about how life is going for the citizens here in the land of steady habits. I'll suppress the scoundrel's name. The headline asks, "Pick on someone your own size?" A Derby man is facing charges that he pinned a 5-year-old boy to the ground during a Father's Day party. Shelton police say that the man, age 33, was attending a party at a daycare center last Friday when the child playfully took a card the man had received from his son. Police say the man chased the child, picked him up, and pinned him to the ground, screaming at him in front of the other children. When officers arrived, the man asked them to have the 5-year-old arrested, police said. The man was charged with risk of injury to a minor and disorderly conduct. And that's the press review for this week. With newspaper readership plummeting, you can depend on New World Notes to scour the provincial press for you and let you know what you've missed. Stay tuned from time to time for more installments of The Press Review. An even better way to catch up on current events is to listen to David Rovick's songs, especially with events that are happening in other countries. The corporate media will rarely tell you what's happening elsewhere in the world unless an American is killed or arrested, or American corporate profits are threatened, or a cute baby animal is born in a zoo in Lower Slobovia. Here's a big hubbub in England that I had never heard of until I heard the David Rovick song a couple of years ago. Big riots that started in the Tottenham neighborhood of North London, then spread to other London neighborhoods, then spread to other cities. Called the Tottenham riots for short. The riots lasted for 6 days, August 6 through 11, 2011. Thousands of people rioted. 3,000 were arrested and 1,000 were charged with crimes. This is bigger than any civil disturbance in the United States for decades. Maybe since the Los Angeles riots in 1992. And what touched off the Tottenham riot? A questionable police shooting of an unarmed black man, Mark Duggan. Sound familiar? Kind of strikes a chord, doesn't it? The problems of police violence, suppression of minorities, and growing anger among the suppressed are pretty common in our neoliberal, plutocratic age everywhere. David Rovick's song is titled "London is Burning."
Coincidental that he was black. He was sitting in his car. They say he might have had a gun. What we know for sure is he had 5 kids, daughters and sons. Now he can't have a family. He'll never see his friends. His neighbors understand what kind of message this sends. Some life is worth less. Some life is worth more. You don't have to be a mathematician to know the score. Some people get shot just for being who they are. Some people play with iPads, take vacations, drive in fancy cars. Some people go to universities, some people do not. It depends on where you were born and how much money you got. The government cuts their spending, widening the divide, then reacts with disbelief when they face the rising tide of anger at the cuts of the futures that they rob. With each day so many have to live without a job. Now the flames are getting hotter, maybe coming to your town. London is burning down. Cameron went on TV in his suit and tie. If the riots asked the question, then this was his reply. We'll arrest these hooligans, these people without shame. They are only criminals, and it's only criminals to blame. Morals have decayed among the peasants' ranks, so let us lock them up while we bail out the banks. When that's the way they look at it, it's not very hard to watch things fall apart in this house of cards. Now the flames are getting hotter, maybe coming to your town. London is burning down. These kids have too much freedom, and all this is just a sign that we need more policemen to teach them some respect. Well, if that's your line, then I know just what you can expect. The class will be repeated until the lesson has been learned. All you need is some injustice to make your cities burn. All you need is the perception, whether or not it's true, that most of us will never live the way you do. Now the flames are getting hotter, maybe coming to your town. London is burning.
World Notes continues with Potpourri number 5. There's a movie out on Netflix and a book to match. It's called Requiem for the American Dream, and it features Noam Chomsky. It's about the 10 ways the powers that be keep the average citizen subordinate and struggling and more or less powerless. Recently, Ralph Nader spent an hour interviewing Chomsky on these matters. Chomsky did most of the talking. We'll hear parts of his fascinating talk now and in future weeks on New World Notes. Here's the first installment.
Reduced democracy is quite important because people, if they had the chance, would never accept the programs that are being imposed. So therefore, you have to reduce democracy. Now, we have to put this a little bit in context. The 1950s and the 1960s were what are sometimes called the golden age of capitalism, which would be called state capitalism. There was the unprecedented high growth rate, and it was essentially egalitarian. So the lowest fifth of the population did about as well in growth as the highest fifth. There was very high taxation of wealth. There was a lot of government planning and intervention. In fact, the current high-tech economy, computers, internet, satellites, microelectronics, and so on, was mostly developed in large part through government coordination and subsidy in the 1950s and 60s. There was also one thing that was happening was an increase in democracy, substantial increase in democracy from the popular movements that were developing during this period. And as you know very well, there was a very sharp reaction to that. The reaction in the early 70s was crucially across the spectrum from conservatives to liberals. The conclusion was we have to reduce democracy. And there are some quite striking documents that bear on this. So one of them from the right was the so-called Powell Memorandum. Lewis Powell, a corporate lawyer working for the tobacco industries and others, later became a Supreme Court justice appointed by Nixon. He wrote a memorandum to the American Chamber of Commerce, you know, the business world. It was supposed to be confidential, but it quickly leaked, and it's quite interesting. What he was saying is, he said the whole country is being taken over by left-wing extremists, and he picked two who were the worst criminals. One of them was Herbert Marcuse, who was running the universities, and the other was Ralph Nader with his consumer safety programs and so on. So these two extreme leftist criminals were undermining the, you know, the free enterprise system and the business world and so on. And it went on with a kind of a long screed like this. But then his conclusion was, look, he said, we businessmen really own the country. We're the trustees of the universities. We're the people who have the resources. We should fight back and not let these hordes of young people and students and other activists overwhelm us. And so we have to fight back and take control. That was the right wing. The liberals are, in a way, more interesting. Roughly the same time, The first study came out from what's called the Trilateral Commission International. It's basically liberal internationalists from the three major industrial democratic centers, Europe, Japan, and the United States. The American rapporteur was Samuel Huntington, well-known Harvard professor. And they produced their political complexion is illustrated by the fact that they basically staffed the Carter administration. So that's where they're coming from in the United States, similarly to the other industrial countries. Their book is called The Crisis of Democracy. And actually, their conclusions are pretty similar to Powell's. It's much less hysterical rhetoric. It's more muted. It's more scholarly. But the essential is the same. They said in the 1960s, there's been too much democracy. Large parts of the population that traditionally are passive and apathetic and obedient are starting to be concerned with their own issues and problems, are trying to enter the political arena, are trying to participate more fully. And they say that's too much pressure on the state. The state can't respond to all these demands. Incidentally, they never mentioned the pressure from the corporate sector, which, of course, has overwhelming influence on the state. But that's okay. That's not a special interest. That's the national interest. We don't mention them. But the special interests, young people, old people, women, blacks, farmers, workers, they're getting too much involved in the political arena. So we need more what they call moderation in democracy. They have to go back to passivity and obedience. And they were particularly concerned with what Huntington called, what the whole group, in fact, called the institutions responsible for the indoctrination of the young. That's their phrase, incidentally, not mine. That means the schools, the universities, the churches, they're not indoctrinating the young properly. So we have to have more discipline and indoctrination in the educational and cultural system to prevent this excess of democracy. So here we have, this kind of symbolizes the general elite mood from right to what's called left, meaning moderately liberal. That's the basic mainstream establishment. The view is we have this too much democracy. It's undermining the business world. And in fact, the rate of profit was decreasing. And it's necessary to reverse this, to have more indoctrination, more passivity, and to undermine democracy. And pretty much that's what's been done.
You've covered the first two principles, reduce democracy and shape ideology, mentioning the Powell memorandum. And the third one is redesign the economy, where they actually put these strategies into place right down where people live, work.
Yeah. Well, the way you redesign the economy was by instituting the, what are called the neoliberal programs, the Washington Consensus, it was sometimes called. It kind of started in the late Carter years. It took off with Reagan and pursued further by Clinton, expanded and on to the present. And this is worldwide, incidentally. It's an effort to reduce the role of the public, which means through the one institution that the public can participate in to some extent, namely the government. In principle and sometimes in practice, people can influence government decisions. So reduce the role of government and transfer it to what's called the market, which means, in effect, private concentrations of capital, corporate concentrations, a very limited market, but that's the idea. So, you know, Reagan's slogan was, government is the problem, not the solution. We have to turn things over to private power, in effect, private tyrannies, because the population has no direct input at all into the decision-making of the corporate sector. The relatively highly integrated systems of power that constitute the corporate sector with, you know, big banks on the boards of many corporations and all sorts of other kinds of integration and relative monopolization, not full, of course. And meanwhile, the financial institutions, one of the major features of the neoliberal period, has been an enormous growth of financial institutions and a change in their character. So if you go back to the 50s and 60s, the period of what's sometimes called regulated capitalism, great growth period, banks were banks. Banks were places where you could deposit some money. They would lend it to somebody for, say, starting a business or building a home or whatever. That's what banks were. They were also regulated by the New Deal regulations, so there were no financial crises. And they functioned as a central part of the state capitalist economy. Starting in the early 70s, that changed radically. Partly it was the breakdown of the whole Bretton Woods system, Nixon's the so-called Nixon shock, but all of this was coordinated. And one of the results was that financial institutions not only grew enormously in size, just exploded, but also changed radically in character. Instead of being connected to the real economy, they more and more were involved in speculation, complicated financial instruments, all the things we've seen. And of course, the deregulation began, late Carter, but particularly Reagan and Clinton. Deregulation meant regular financial crises. Financial crises means the public bails out the big banks for their predatory activities. We saw this again in 2007, 2008.
Two great progressive voices of our time, Ralph Nader and Noam Chomsky. More of this will follow, God willing. Audio courtesy of the Ralph Nader Radio Hour. I have condensed and edited the audio a little. And as William Blake wrote about this very installment of our show back in 1793, enough or too much. And he's right. But if you believe the road of excess leads to the Palace of Wisdom, you can find more at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, urging illegitimi non-carborundum, and hoping you'll tune in again next week. Till then.